Energy to order. And with that, Gary, I'll ask you to introduce yourself and Bill, and we'll go ahead and start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Gary Weeks. I'm the Director of the Department of Human Services, and with me today is Bill Crowell, who is our Chief Information Officer. And we appreciate very much this chance to talk with you a little bit about information technology and how it impacts the department. I thought, Mr. Chairman, since several of your members hadn't worked with the department, I might just spend a few minutes giving some context to the department now, and you can stop me at whatever point, because I realize that I've talked to you as well as Representative Roblin a bit about this, and you have our yellow folder that has everything in it. But I'll just try to lay out a little bit so we can get the technology service in the context of the department and what we do and what we need. And I'll try to do that quickly so that the bulk of this can be left to Bill. I should say Bill is fairly new to government. He came to us in April. When I came to the department for what is now my second tour of duty, I was the director of the department under the Kitzhaber administration from 1995 until early 2001. And when I came back in March of last year, 2004, for the second time, one of my first duties was actually to find a new CIO. We did a national recruitment, and I was specifically looking for people that had a pretty broad background, you know, not just a public service background. And we had a lot of people engaged in this search. Bill probably was interviewed by more people than he wants to remember. But the result is we hired somebody that I think is really a very, very capable person to run our technology program here. His experience is in the private sector largely, working with McGraw-Hill out of New York and a company in Des Moines.
Meredith
in Des Moines. And then he did a stint with the U.S. Treasury Service, and he can tell you more about his background. But we were able to find someone that I thought brought a pretty broad background and in a private sector background into the department to give us some new ways of thinking about things. So let me, again, just very quickly talk a little bit about the department. I think you all know that this is the state's largest department. We served about 950,000 unduplicated clients in 2003, and the data for 2004 will be available pretty soon. I suspect it'll be close to 1 million unduplicated clients. We're served through public health programs, child protective services, vocational rehabilitation, mental health services, addiction services, services for people with disabilities of both a physical and a developmental nature, and seniors. So we have pretty much the full gamut of folks that are impacted by a human services agency. Much of the work that we do is not done by state employees. It's done by contracts that we have with county government, with nonprofits that include your typical nonprofit organizations as well as church-related organizations. So we are a huge contractor. That's how we get our business done out in the field. We have about, in the current biennium, we have about 9,500 positions, amounts to 9,100 FTE. The governor's recommended budget actually reduces that number by about 250 positions for the 2005-2007 biennium. The budget is $9.2 billion for the current biennium. 24% of that is general fund, 64% of that is federal funds, 11% comes in the form of other funds, which are largely fees that we collect. And then there's about $5.5 million worth of state lottery proceeds that come to the department. Most of the money that we have actually goes back to the community. 83% of all the dollars appropriated to the department or given to the department through an expenditure limitation are distributed back through communities to pay for either client benefits or client services. 13% is used for direct services that we provide. Most of that is through things like the Oregon State Hospital, Eastern Oregon Psych Center, and Eastern Oregon Training Center, the mental hospital, the small mental hospital that we have up in Portland. Those are the direct services, and they're about 13% of the budget. And then we operate on about 4% administrative costs for all of the department. We leverage a lot of federal funds, I think, as you all may know. 67% of the general fund that we get is actually used to leverage federal funds, and are part of that total of $5.9 billion in federal funds that comes into the department. This department is fairly old by most standards of state government. It was created in 1971. And at that time, the legislature wanted to bring together all the various separate agencies that were providing human services. So the original creation of it included the mental health programs, public health, public welfare, corrections for both adults and juveniles, the employment department, voc rehab. Those were all separate and distinct parts in 1971, and they were brought together, creating a new agency. And much of the expectation at that time was that by bringing all this together, you'd create some synergy in the work, you would create a better opportunity for those different agencies to leverage their resources, and you would create a much better integration of services for people that were the clients of the agency. Much of that didn't happen, frankly, for several years. I mean, I've spoken on this. Dallas has heard me many times, because while the legislature created this agency, brought everything together, they then walked the budget across the hall to Ways and Means, and each one of the divisions was given a separate appropriation, a separate FTE limit. Each one of the divisions had its own payroll, personnel, accounting, data systems, so on. So they created a single agency, but really, and I don't think anybody did this consciously, but they really created an agency where everybody was on their own as a division. And that lasted for a long time. And frankly, when I took this job in 1995, right after Governor Kitzhaber was elected, and we talked about the work, and I said, if you want me to do this, I have a different vision. You know, I have a vision that's closer to 1971, which is we need to have a really integrated agency. We don't need six personnel shops, and we don't need six data processing shops or what, you know, all of that. And so from 1995 till when I left the department, and I left to go to the Casey Foundation in Baltimore to start a new program for that organization, but we really focused on trying to bring these divisions together. And there were several pieces of legislation that I took with the governor's support to the legislature that changed the authority of the divisions, that began to take away the budget authority as well as the individual authority. When I started in this job, the division administrators actually had more authority than the director did. They could contract. Two of them were Senate-confirmed positions. The bills that I worked through the governor's office did away with all of that, and we began to merge the budgets. And as Dallas knows, we began to work on a shared services model for administration, so that we took the authority for all of those separate administrative pieces away from the division, and we today have a shared services model. We have one personnel shop, we have one payroll operation, we have one accounting and one purchasing operation, and we have one technology system, which Bill is responsible for. That took a lot. I mean, wrestling that kind of authority back from historically distributed functions was not fun, but it was the right thing to do. And during that time, I was also able to bring on some people in leadership positions, I think, who had a different vision for the way we would work together. And so we managed that change, what I think was a significant change in the agency. And over the years, parts of this agency were spun off as they became bigger and bigger. For example, corrections was spun off from the department in 1987. The employment function was spun off in 1993 when the employment department was created. Juvenile corrections was spun off in 1996 when the Oregon Youth Authority was created. So those pieces are no longer in the department and exist as separate agencies. In 2001, there was a reorganization that began under the leadership of Governor Kitzhaber at that time that resulted in further consolidating the agency. So we actually did away, and I was not here for that period of time, but the agency did away with the divisions and created clusters of services. So we now have three clusters of services. We have services for children and families that include child welfare, vocational rehabilitation, the TANF program, which is the federal welfare to work program. Those are all part of what we call children and families cluster. The offices, the field offices for that group of responsibilities, there are 150 field offices. Those are now organized by county into 16 service delivery areas. Each service delivery area has a manager, so we consolidated the staff in the field as well. The second cluster is a health cluster, which includes mental health services, alcohol and drug abuse prevention and treatment, the Oregon Health Plan. I guess that's it. That's where the state hospital budget is. And then the third cluster is something we call seniors and people with disabilities. So it's all senior services, services for people with physical and developmental disabilities, and those sorts of services. Then we have a fourth cluster that is all of our admin. That's all the shared services that I described earlier are in this one cluster. And then the final cluster is called finance and policy. Finance and policy is where the budget resides and all the forecasting staff and so on like that. So that's the structure that's in place today as a result of that 2001 reorganization. That's the structure that the Ways and Means Committee will review. Having briefly said all that, obviously we couldn't do our work without information technology. And we are constantly struggling to stay abreast of the work we have to do with the systems that are in place. We have a great number of legacy systems that hang in there, but you know, are struggling to keep pace. Some of the more vital systems are our medical management information system, MMIS, which is what drives the health plan. We're in the midst of redoing the MMIS system. We have made a decision about a year ago, I suppose, to contract the development of this system out, as well as the running of this system. So it will be privately developed with us and run outside of the agency. The RFPs went out for that. We had four proposals just come in because the RFP period ended. And the proposals are for, again, the design and the development and the implementation of the system. And we have proposals from ACS, CNSI, EDS, and First Health. So we've got four very strong companies that are bidding to help us develop the medical management information system.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Representative Brennan.
Thank you. Hi, Gary.
Excuse me. What's your name?
With regards to the MMIS program, is that going to be an off-the-shelf type of product that then is adapted and implemented, or are we going to self-develop and self-implement and all of that kind of stuff? I mean, I understand you've got companies that would do this, but in other words, is it going to be a customized product that then can't be upgraded because it's written in language that 10 years from now is too old, nobody recognizes anymore, because instead of C++, it's now C++ with B added, or whatever names they come up with?
Thank you, Representative Crummell. My name is Bill Kroll, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Human Services. And as Gary indicated, we have now four proposals from vendors to design, develop, and implement, then maintain and operate a new MMIS system. Generally speaking, there are different approaches from all of those four vendors, but generally speaking, we're looking at taking an existing system that is operating in another state and implementing that system as closely as possible to the way it is built today, with as minimum modifications as possible. In my experience, and how I've advised the department, that is the best way to get it done quickly, to get it done at the lowest possible cost and the minimum risk. And after you've done that, you can then look at, you know, what additional enhancements you might want to make to the system. But that's an integral part of our business plan and our strategies, which I'll be just talking about in a second.
Okay.
Ironically, I think you could probably describe the existing MMIS system as off the shelf because we bought it in 1981 from Missouri. It was a fee-for-service system that we bought from Missouri and then modified it over the years to make it fit a managed care environment. So it's been worked every number of ways, but we did initially acquire it from somewhere else. A couple other systems that...
Excuse me, John, for interrupting, and thank you for that. In developing this system, I'm sure there's a lead time to determine that you need something new. How long has this system been in the mill, your new IT system? How long has it been on the idea to implementation?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's been close to a couple of years that we've been working on this because we had to go to the legislature to get the authority to begin the project, and then we apply to the federal government. We do what's called an APD, an advanced placement document, which secures the federal funding, the match that we need for this, and all that takes considerable amount of time. So we've been working on this idea of, in the legislature, Mr. Chairman, has known for a long time we had to redo the MMIS system. So it's been in the works for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Another system that is in the governor's budget for some funding to bring it more up to date is the state automated child welfare system, SACWA system. It's what we depend on in our whole child welfare system. Again, we're really struggling with that system right now, and if the legislature approves the governor's recommendation, there would be some money to begin to rebuild that system. Before I turn it over to Bill, just a couple of other things I want to say to you. One issue that's really paramount for us, but I also think the rest of the government, is the security of our system. We have so much information about individuals that deals with their mental health state, their addiction state, their physical health state, that the security of our system has to be one of the paramount things. And that's part of why I hired Bill, is because of his experience in this particular area. But it's going to be a point that we will continue to try to drive home with the legislature, that we have to do everything possible to secure this system. And unfortunately, because of the nature of the way we do our business, where we have so many local partners, lots of people come into our system. And let me give you an example of how we don't realize that until certain things happen. When we switched over at midnight on the year 2000, we'd spent the whole year getting ready for Y2K, and I was with my staff that whole night. 10 o'clock before we were ready to switch over, we get a call from Benton County letting us know that their fire and police and other emergency systems have been piggybacking for a long time on our system. Well, we're getting ready to shut this down. We're two hours away from shutting everything down and then starting back up again, which would have meant they had, you know, no communication system, no access to information and so on like that. So in a couple hours, we had to jerry-rig. We had to find an alternative workaround for the county in a very short period of time, and we had no idea that was happening. They were just coming into the system because they had access to it for legitimate reasons. The county is a major provider for us, and so it caused us to really begin to look and see who else is entering this system and using it, you know, using us as a backbone for a variety of things. And we've cleaned up a lot of that, but the security issue continues to be, I think, a major issue for us. So I'm gonna stop now. I want Bill to take some time to explain the business plan to you. We bought a copy of that for them. This business plan is probably the most complete and the most thorough piece of work we've done as an agency. And I've worked with the agency for close to 10 years now, 2 years as the deputy, and close to 8 years as the director. I think Bill's done and his staff have all done a terrific job of aligning out a business plan for us that will sort of set the future up for us and where we want to go. So I want him to have some time talking through that, and maybe we can talk a little bit about the MMIS plan. And this plan, as some of you may imagine, it's a little bit controversial, the way we're approaching MMIS, using a private sector firm to not only do the development and the implementation, but also the management. And that's been something we've had to work through carefully with our representing employees, our unions, and it continues to be a difficult discussion. But we're moving forward with it, obviously, because we're getting ready to select a vendor. So okay. With that, I'm going
to... Before we get to that issue, one of the areas that I'm very concerned with, you've talked about 2 years, you're ready. Implementation date is what? Fire up, light up.
MMIS.
For Representative Down, the turn on date is 27 months from June, so I think it's in 2007. And it's around September, October.
And you've spoke of working with state associations. If 2007 is the light-up time, what would it, in your conversations with the associations, what arrangements have you made with them?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what we are trying to work through with our representing employees is a way to assure that we're not going to displace people. We have a lot of turnover. We need talented and experienced people, and our efforts are going to be focused on trying to retain those people as we have turnover and so on, that we slot people in. It doesn't do us any good to lose people that we've invested time and energy in training. So, but the dilemma for us here is, and I think Representative Crummell actually suggested it earlier, is that we don't have on our staff today the capacity to write a system like MMIS. The languages that are required and the programming skills and software skills, we simply don't have today. And we can't, while we invest in training, it would take far too long for us to train people to get them up to speed to be able to take this on. And so that's why we moved to the model that we did, to look for another state that has a system that we could bring in and to contract out for the development of it.
And I certainly don't want to put words in your mouth, but you have been working with the state association, and basically you've come to some agreement that attrition and replacement will ensure that none of the association's present bodies, workers, FTE, will be lost. And are you providing training for them? Could you give me some notion of what the training timeline is and how that training is working?
I'll let Bill do that, but let me make sure. I don't want to be unclear. We are working with the union representatives to assure the employment of folks. It would be a misrepresentation for me to say that they agree with the strategy that we've embarked on, that is to have a private sector development. I mean, I think they continue to believe that with enough time, our employees could actually develop this. So while we're together on trying to retain people, we're not together in terms of is this really the right direction to go. So, Ben, right. Can you talk a little bit about the training side of
sure.
this?
Sure. Representative Dowell and members of the committee, we have implemented and communicated to all the employees and to the union a transition plan for the approximately 44 staff members that will be impacted by not only the design, development, and implementation of a new MMIS system, but the outsourcing essentially of maintenance and operation of that system, which is what these people do today for our existing or current MMIS. And that plan has several key elements of it. First of all, it recognizes that developing a transition plan for employees is a one-on-one discussion with the state. We need to work with every one of those 44 individuals as individuals and understand what their desires are and what they want to do with their careers. So the first step of that plan is to conduct interviews with them and decide with them what they're looking for as a career path. Do they want to stay in applications? Do they want to go into desktop or some other part of IT as a career path? Secondly, we are in the process of putting out on the street an RFP for a professional firm to come in and interview these employees and understand assess their current skill levels and understand where they want to go with their careers and identify any gaps that might exist that we could fill in some way that we could address. in terms of their skills and background. A lot of these individuals have been for many, many years basically COBOL programmers, and that's their extent of their background. So we're going to do that assessment, and then we plan to have to develop a developmental plan for each employee that says, here's, you know, what training you might need, here's how we might find you a rotational or developmental or a workout of class assignment that would give you the experience to apply some of that training and hopefully secure a new position. And obviously, as vacancies come to place or as new positions need to be filled, we're working with them, encouraging those employees to apply for those. An example of that specifically is in the MMIS initiative, there's about 8 business analysts who actually work in the business to develop the requirements and testing and conversion and those kinds of things that have to be done in implementing a system this size. And we're encouraging these 44 people to apply for those open positions. And in fact, I think I've moved one in to one of those open positions on a rotational assignment, actually direct assigning them. So we're working very, very hard with the individual employees. With respect to our relationship with the union, it is good. I mean, they appreciate, I think, the positive steps that the director and myself and other managers are taking on this issue. But there is a fundamental disagreement with the union on our approach, and that issue is now before an arbitration panel.
Mr. Chairman, I think I should also point out we've done this before. When I was managing the department under the Kitzhaber administration, it was my administration that closed Fairview. Fairview was a developmental disabilities institution that was built 95 years before. It had 1,300 employees. They were all AFSCME employees serving about 350 residents in a 24-hour care setting. When we closed that, we did a mammoth effort for reemployment, and it took us about 2.5 years to close Fairview. In the end, there were less than 30 people that were involuntarily laid off because we got federal grants to create a federal training program. We actually opened a federally funded employment office on the campus of Fairview, and it was a great partnership with the union to try to find people employment so that we didn't just create unemployment amongst our workers. And I think it was a good example of how government can do this if you set your mind to it. So,
Mr. Chair? Yes, Reverend Cullen.
I have a being in a profession myself that requires continuing education for maintaining certifications and that sort of thing. Bill, you made the comment that, you know, programming folks have, you know, they started with COBOL. Well, I happen to know that COBOL was in the 70s, because the first computer science class I ever took was at Lewis and Clark, and it was while I was working there, and they were talking about COBOL, and it was a fairly new language then. But given that we have a lot of new languages that have come out since then, why wouldn't a person whose livelihood depends on being up to date with the most advanced technology available, why would they not, and they're a programmer, why would they not keep up with programming languages, even though what they're required to do at work is such an old system that it's still operating on COBOL as the language?
Representative Cromwell and members of the committee, it's a very good question. I'm in a profession, as you know, that is changing at rapid speed. 2 or 3 years, the technology sometimes changes very dramatically. I think to some extent, first of all, I would say that I don't think we can group all of the people who are affected by this particular change as one lump. There are some people who have, you know, on their own time or through their own activities, you know, experimented with other technologies and kept their skill sets probably pretty up to date. But it's not genuinely true across the whole spectrum of the people that are involved. And to some extent, they may have become comfortable, is my reaction in, you know, in they were able to come in and do their job effectively with the knowledge that they had, and that became a comfortable environment. A little bit of what we do in the business plan is make it clear to all of our employees now that it's not a question of whether we will or have to change, it's how quickly and how fast and where we want to change and how we're going to change. And so it's a very important part of the cultural piece of our plan to get the mindset changed amongst all the employees in IT within the Department of Human Services that we're in an exciting and challenging area and that we're going to have to make major transformations in skill sets. And we'll be talking a lot about that in our plan, specifically how we plan to do that.
I think if I could add to that, Mr. Chairman, we have some responsibility in the number of people doing COBOL now, because when we were trying to get ready for Y2K, everything was written in COBOL. And we couldn't get COBOL people. I mean, prior to Y2K, you could hire COBOL people pretty darn easily. And I don't mean to disparage their skill level. I'm just saying because it was an older language, it was easy to hire them. When Y2K came upon us and everybody found their languages were all COBOL historically, in order to get COBOL programmers, you had to pay bonuses, and we did. You can go back and look at our HR policies back in 99 and 98, because we were increasing wages for COBOL programs. Not only did we do that, but because we couldn't hire enough at state wages, we set up this unique partnership with Chemeketa to provide a training program for COBOL programmers, people who in throughout the department weren't necessarily even IT people but wanted a change in career. And we trained, I've forgotten now how many COBOL programmers through this partnership with Chemeketa, and then hired them to help us get through Y2K, knowing all along that once we got through Y2K and we began to have to redo our systems, we probably weren't going to need all that COBOL planning. But, I mean, you're stuck. You've got to get through Y2K, and the only way you can do it is hire as many COBOL programmers as you can, and then you get through Y2K and you know, we don't have a lot of work for these COBOL programmers down the road. So, in fairness, I mean, we have to say it's not solely the employees, I think, because in some cases they did what we asked them to do. So,
may I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Certainly, Representative Cummins.
Thank you. I can understand that, and having been here during the 99 session, and Y2K was on our minds, and I was actually on the Commerce Committee, and we spent a great deal of time in that on the Y2K issues. But were those folks that were then trained at the state's request and hired at the state's beckoning, then considered to be regular, full-time, permanent employees, or were they supposed to be actually temporary employees to get us through that particular? And if the option, then if there was a need to keep the person because they had good skill sets or whatever the case may be, then they could be put on permanent status, but otherwise they were temporary employees. That then after the Y2K issue was basically resolved, they were free to go somewhere else.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Cromwell, because they came from permanent employees, they were all permanent employees who applied for, and we hand selected people to go to the Chemeketa program, and we started them well before Y2K, and we knew that, you know, come December 31st of 1999, it didn't mean they all went away. We spent at least a year, maybe longer, trying to still clean up a lot of things. And so they were permanent employees when they came and volunteered to get trained to do this because we needed the help. And, you know, we didn't feel like we could take permanent employees and say, if you'll train to get some COBOL skills, which we need to get through Y2K, then when we're done, you don't have a job. So the short answer is they were permanents, and they remained permanents, and we tried to place them in some cases back in other parts of the department.
Okay. If I could come back on you two questions later. I ask the Department of Human Services to come and give us their business plan and look at their schedule. And I know you have lots of questions, but I'd like to give Bill a little bit of time. And if you'll hold your...
It directs to that, actually. Okay. This is a short one.
We'll have one more question, and then we'll give Bill a chance to study stuff.
Thank you, Chair. In fact, is the discussion we just had part of the reason we're moving to the plan that we've gone to, in that in this way it is not the responsibility of the state to keep up with the technology and the new writing and software, but actually whoever we contract, their employees are going to stay up to tune with that. We'll have a few people who can interact with them and understand, but it isn't the responsibility of the state then to keep moving all this stuff to whatever the newest thing is. It becomes our contractor's responsibility in part.
Representative Down and Representative Roblin, the members of the committee, the strategy that we've implemented does take into effect the inherent risks of attempting to implement a major new system of the size of MMIS. MMIS is the largest single application in the state, and it would be a very high-risk strategy to try to get somebody else to implement that and then try to take our existing employees and train them in a whole new set of technologies to maintain and support it. So we're primarily driven by minimization of risk. Another factor I think is really critical in this decision is that when you contract out to have a system built or implemented in the way that we are doing it, you really don't want that contractor to be able to say, well, I'm just going to skirt this issue and let the maintenance crews deal with it down the road, because that's a major risk, quite frankly, in that development environment. And so making that same company responsible for not only building it but maintaining and operating it over an extended period of time, again, is a way of keeping accountability and responsibility where it should be in that type of relationship.
I'm glad we have one more question, Representative Roblin. And with that, we'll get Bill up and hear what he has to say. And if you have questions, we'll get to him, I promise you.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a real pleasure for me to be here today. I'm sure we're going to be working very closely together in this session of the legislature, and hopefully in future sessions as well. It might be helpful for me to set some context before I go into the plan itself. First of all, a little bit about my background. I grew up in Virginia, got my undergraduate degree in economics, and got an MBA degree from the University of Virginia Darden School. And then I spent about 30 plus years in technology, everything from helping to reorganize the Penn Central Railroad to creating new information systems and publishing, both at McGraw-Hill and then at Meredith Corporation. Helped run a joint venture for Ross Perot during my career, so I've had a lot of varied experiences, but all of it in the area of working with senior management and developing IT plans and then executing them successfully within the business context. And I believe as I interviewed for this job with Gary and Cindy and other members of the department, especially the cabinet members, I got a very clear view from them that the ability to create and then execute a plan successfully and the demonstrated ability to do that was really, really critical to the department. And after joining the department after only a couple of months, I realized how really important this was, that a lot of what we had done over the years had happened, but not because of a conscious, necessary plan. And most importantly, there were clear examples where the business did not have a deep and fundamental understanding of where we were from an information technology standpoint and what we would need to do, what strategies we'd need to implement to really modernize this organization. So that's really the context around this plan. And I'm not going to try to cover every slide in this. There's 83 of them. I do it with my staff. It takes about 2 hours usually for me to get through that. So I'm going to kind of selectively go through and hit some things. If as I do that, there's something that I've glossed over, please feel free to halt me and ask me about that topic. I'll start with the purpose of the plan on page 3. And as is true of any plan, this is a roadmap to engineer IT business processes within the organization. There's a lot of work to do there. Most importantly, to align our resources with the direction and strategic needs of the department itself, and to modernize our technology. That's a crucial element here. We have technologies that are relatively old, 30-plus years in many cases, and we really need to bring them up to speed. And the purpose of all this is delivering greater IT value to the business and to the department. That's really, really crucial. We look at everything we do in terms of, is this value added? Will this make a difference? I'll skip over page 4 very briefly. That just, for if you're not familiar with the department, gives our organization chart. One thing you'll note is on this chart, I'm shown reporting to Gary, which I do. In the budget documents, you'll see that my position actually is a part of DWSS. So it shows it's a part of Clyde Psyche's administrative services group. Okay? The next slide basically just covers, as Gary did, a high-level view of what the different groups within the department do. But the next one on page 6, the slide there, is really, really crucial because we took this directly out of the department's budget document submission, where they're required to define their 6-year plan and their long-term strategies within that planning period. And these 5 initiatives are the ones that the department highlighted, and as you look at them, at least as you look at them through my eyes as the CIO, you see the incredible importance of our IT business plan and the importance of technology to the department's long-term strategies. Continuing to focus on service integration, for example, we've done a good job of that from a management perspective, but the systems and the methods and the processes that these businesses are using on an integrated basis aren't integrated, and they make it very difficult for them to operate on a day-to-day basis. So it's a major focus of our plan, is service integration and supporting that, enabling that. We talk here about expanding the community infrastructure, and that means that we need a very robust network that not only connects with the department and other areas of the state government, but with outside service providers, people who are not a part of the department, as we talked about earlier. Obviously, the third bullet is dead on in terms of what the cabinet wants us to achieve, and that is transformation of the information systems within the department. And the key word here is transformation, which is central to this plan. We're not talking about tinkering around the edges here. We're talking about fairly basic and significant changes in how we provide and what we provide as IT services to the department. Improving credibility and accountability is all about information. And it's about the quality of that information. And this is a major responsibility of IT to help the business understand and develop a better data management and architecture for its information so that it has more credibility. We are actually having discussions at the cabinet level now about things like who's a client and what's workload and what's caseload and these very fundamental pieces of information that are needed to communicate what we do and how we do it. And that's very important. I'm really excited about the fact that we're working at it even at that level. And then finally, addressing the training needs of DHS employees. There's been, as Gary talked about, substantial turnover in the staff. And we need very broad and expansive training programs. And this is an area where, again, technology can be an enabler through things like NetLinks, which is a distance learning technology that we've implemented in the department, through video conferencing, which we're in the process of extending and expanding throughout the department. So, again, even in the training area, technology can play a vital role in the department's activities. On slide 7, we give a brief overview of the OIS organization, and we have a fairly traditional structure here, and we designed this to really relate directly to the major initiatives and to the business of running DHS. Our first area is Network and Computing Services, you'll see on the slide. This is the group that manages our computer center and our network. It is the group that is going to be transferred to the CNIC State Data Center and Network activity, and I'll talk about that in a while here because DHS has been a very strong supporter. In fact, I think, in effect, sometimes pushing the envelope with the state as to what that new data center and network should look like and how it should be organized. So I'll talk a lot about that. And we're, and our people are very strong supporters of that initiative. Our strategic systems initiatives, I created that because we are doing a lot of very significant systems. MMIS is one of the biggest in the state. SACWIS will be another very large, complex system we're implementing. We're doing HIPAA, self-sufficiency and other systems replacements here. And I wanted a group, I wanted to make sure that we separate these major systems out of the day-to-day operations of IT so that we can dedicate resources to them. In my experience, that's key to success of these large and complex projects. And I wanted especially to have an eye on these so that we were effectively communicating with DAS and with JLCIMT and with the legislature in general about what these projects were and where they were going. So this is really what you'll see as we move out of session into JLCIMT, the kinds of systems that we'll be bringing forward to talk to you about. The applications maintenance and support area is organized by the clusters, and this is the group of people, approximately 200, in fact, of the group that handle the day-to-day maintenance and operations and production support of our existing systems. It's an enormous investment, and I'll talk a little bit about what we need to do there and some of the changes we're making. In the customer service and support, this is what we call the desktop, the help desk. This is the group of people that deal with the 9,000 plus employees of DHS on a day-to-day basis. And their role, and this really was a change of mindset for them, and their paradigm should be customer service and support. They're there to serve the customers, make sure that they're getting the support that they need, that we're quick to respond to issues when they come up. And again, I'll talk a little bit more about that area. Our systems architects are the senior people in technology that have the most background and skills and diversity of experience. That includes our database administrators, again, a very critical resource. We separated them out because we need to share that resource not only across strategic systems but across maintenance of existing operations, and we didn't want them to be encumbered in one area and not be able to gain their expertise across the organization. In a sense, they will become over time our high-powered systems consultants internally to the department. We then have a series of administrative functions. It's a large part of DHS, almost 400 people, several hundred million dollars in budget. So we have some people working that. We have a group called policy and planning, and they work on policy and planning types of issues around IT, which is very important. Our PMO, our project management office, is a really key element. It has made a great difference in how we run projects within the department and the professionalism and experience of our project managers. We are actually now offering the PMO services, which are advisory and skills and training. It's not running projects, but teaching people how to run projects and giving them the tools to run projects. We're now offering that service to other areas of the department because there are many non-IT functions that run projects and can benefit from project management discipline. And so we're sharing that across the department. The last area we're just getting organized around we have now in the Office of the Director business process improvement initiatives that have been started. A key aspect of business process improvement is technology, the enabling technologies to make some of those improvements, and we'll be building some talent and skills and background in that area that we don't have today. Okay? Now, when I arrived, one of the first issues, I'm moving on to slide 8, that was raised almost in every conversation was to recognize that I had this fairly substantial challenges in front of me, and of course we didn't have adequate resources to address it, and that was just a given. And I really felt in the context of this assessment and strategy we're going to take to develop this plan that we really need to explore that presumption or that assumption. So what I did here is I took the departmental overall total funds budget of $9.22 billion in this biennium, and I, working with financial planning analysis, said, what part of that is pass-through money, that comes into us and we send it on, like TANF benefits and food stamps and those kinds of payments, versus what are the costs of operating this department, where we have people and programs and services and, you know, that actually do the work. And that turned out to be about $1.62 billion, or 17.6% of the total. I then said, okay, of that total, and that moves to the second pie chart here, what does IT represent? What investment is the department making in technology as a part of its operating budget? And as you can see here, we have about $72 million in this year's budget for MMIS and Express for projects, major project budgets, and about $76 million for ongoing operations. And that's about 9.1% of the operating budget. And as you can see, most of this cost, most of this resource goes into people. It's almost 60% of our total mix of costs is people and people-related expenses. And then hardware and software is the other major piece, a little bit for S&S and professional services. We then said, well, what is the governor's recommended budget? How do we look there? How is things changing? As you can see, the total funds are up to some extent, but IT is $90 million for projects because we've added SACWIS in the governor's recommended budget. And our operating costs are increasing about $80 million, so we're about 10.2% of the operating budget. The mix really doesn't change a great deal as we look at the next biennium. So moving on to page 10, what does this tell you? Well, first it tells me that OIS appears to have sufficient resources available to serve the department's requirements. Okay, there's not a scarcity here. And most importantly, as we have big investment requirements, we are getting those funded, largely through COPs. And so that supports the kind of investments we're going to need to make in technology to modernize our systems. So the real issue is not how much resources the legislature is providing to me as the CIO to get the job done. It's how well I use those resources, which is the challenge. And as we'll go through the plan, you'll see we've got some challenges because we haven't necessarily used or utilized those resources in the most productive manner. Okay? The next slide on burning platforms was something that I asked our executive team to look at because it's very important that as you talk about major changes, as we are talking about in this plan, that people have a sense of why you need to do this. It's not only important to OIS, it's important to our business partners to understand, it's important to you to understand what we face as issues. And this was basically a kind of a brainstorming type of piece of information where we said, look at staff, look at clients, look at finance, look at systems, and tell us, you know, what you see as to the major reasons we need to change. And if I look at staff, to me, one of the most basic issues as we go through the plan that you'll see is the enormous fragmentation of our people because of the wide diversity of technologies we're currently supporting. In the client area, we're an inhibitor. The last thing the business wants to hear when they have a new initiative that they want, you know, to implement is, oh my gosh, we got to go to IT. You know, and they've got to make changes, and that means 6-7 years, you know, or some enormous amount of time and expense. So we see that as we need to change that mindset. We need to be much more responsive. We need to have systems that show a single view of the client. We can't do that. How can you integrate services if you can't get a kind of comprehensive and holistic view of your customer and your clients? And, of course, the way we're operating today as we go through it, you'll see, is probably one of the most expensive ways we could provide the service because of the fragmentation and the lack of a strategy. Okay? Now, the plan itself has three major things we go through. First thing we want to do is say, where are we at? What's our point of departure? Where are we today? What's the assessment of this particular area of IT? What are the issues associated with that assessment? We then develop strategies specifically to address the issues that we see in the area, and then we want to define a point of arrival. What's the goal? What tells me when I'm there? What will communicate the performance metrics that we can look at and say, when I've accomplished this, this, and this, I'll know that I have achieved the strategies that I've laid out. So I'll go now to page 14. We're really into the heart of the plan at this point. This is the detailed assessments that we went through. And I'll start with applications. This is obviously the most critical value area of IT. This is where we deliver applications to the business that make a difference. And so where are we today in that environment? Well, we have over 250 plus applications that we're supporting. They're written in 22 different languages. We have 9 different database management technologies that support it. And we have 5 different technical platforms in which we provide that service over from a mainframe down to a PC type application. This is complexity to a fairly well. We're not managing IT within the United States. We're managing more like in greater Europe and the Far East in terms of just the number of languages that we have to be skilled at. So this said to us, we've got a real question mark in terms of our strategies and areas of applications. We then said to ourselves, well, okay, that's the big picture, but what about the 10 largest systems that the department operates? They clearly have to be less complex, more congruent. I mean, than what we have in the broader picture. And of course, the answer is on slide 16, and the answer is that's not true. In our 10 largest applications, which date back 30 plus years, and some as current as 2003, two years ago, we have 7 different languages that we're supporting, 5 different types of databases, and 3 different types of technical platforms. Okay? So it's not just this broad brush picture, it's the top 10. So I look at that and what I see is veneer. I see staff spread over a large veneer of technologies that is about as deep as the veneer would be on this table. It's very thin. We don't have a lot of support. We then went on to say, is that the way it has to be? What about the business itself? Well, in fact, there are a lot of commonalities across this business. It's a very complex business, DHS. There's a lot of different businesses that we're in. But there are areas where there's great similarities. One is self-sufficiency. There are 30-some self-sufficiency programs that the department manages both for the regular population and seniors. And if you look at TANF and food stamps and these others, what you see is there's very similar functionality going on within them. We have some type of intake of new clients. We screen them. We determine their eligibility. We set up a case management process for them, et cetera. This has been seen in the marketplace, and there are solutions out there. I can say there is a light at the end of the tunnel where people are starting to see this consistent technology or consistent functionality across many programs, and you can technologically today implement something for each of these programs, have different business rules, but have a common application supporting all of that application, and therefore have depth. We then said, well, let's look within applications at specific functions, and hopefully there we'll find some more commonality. And again, we found the same type of diversity. Client demographics, we have 39 applications that have client demographic pieces to them. They're in 16 different languages again. In the licensing area, and this is actually licensing only in public health, our total licensing inventory is probably closer to 50 plus. 10 different languages supporting that. And if you're familiar with some of the things happening in the state, DCBS has recently acquired a common technology for licensing. License 2000, 27, 8 states, I think it's in, 4,000 licenses. There's solutions in the marketplace that would allow us to simplify and have more common applications. So that's a critical aspect. We then looked at another little important factor, and that is how does our staff mix change as we do these major new projects, Express, and when those finish and they go into maintenance and operations, what tends to happen, or what's tend to happen in the past, and Gartner, this is where a Gartner diagram showed that we would eat up the capacity for maintenance operation. We were sucking off the ability to do new and changing technology because we had to support and maintain what we'd just done in the system. So this means that we really need to be conscious as we develop our strategies to implement these systems to work with the business to stabilize the current systems and make them break fix, basically, and move staff into these new applications, let them participate and get the skills that they need to implement these new systems, and then bring them back into maintenance and operation in a way that we're not chewing up more resources on an ongoing basis, that we're really leveraging those capabilities. So with this in mind, what we found is that systems are actually inhibiting, we're inhibitors to business operations and service integration across clusters in business. And that's something we need to fix. But our IT staff is incredibly fragmented and lack any depth in any of the technologies that we're supporting. And third, that this is probably, as I said, the most least cost-effective way to be running IT. Greater resource drains, greater time frames, duplication of functionality. So we're spending resources to do X, and then we're spending resources to do X again in the way that we've been organized, and lacks of standardization. All of this happening in a context of a business environment which is undergoing more and more rapid and change and needs us to be more flexible. So we said, well, how do we solve this? Well, the first thing that we decided we needed to do is make it clear to ourselves and to the business that this is a complex operation and that one silver bullet is not out there that's going to make all this well. But we can simplify the complexity of our current applications portfolios. So we'll talk a little bit about the portfolio management strategy, and I'll have a next slide talk about that in more detail. Secondly, we need to do what the private sector has been doing pretty much for the last 10 or 15, if not 20 years, and that's look to businesses who are in the business of developing these applications on a commercial off-the-shelf basis. And we need to buy our solutions and not try to build them. Most of the things we go back through now and see that our problems are ones that we tried to build and the technology changed underneath us and we couldn't react. The ones we bought, actually, we've gone through two or three cycles of technology change and they're current as they can be. And the reason is that there was a mechanism in place to maintain them. Third, our staff needs to be retrained and retooled. They need to become less development-oriented and more implementers, better knowledge of the business, better knowledge and in-depth of what these commercial off-the-shelf packages can do and how they do them and assist the business in implementing them. And the last piece is critical because it really affects the business. We need to teach the business, basically, that where success has happened in technology is where we acquire technologies and implement them and really learn them and discover what they're all about before we start major modifications or changes. If you want to ensure the highest cost, the most time, and the greatest risk, buy commercial off-the-shelf packages and start to make major modifications to them. It's not a pretty picture in the industry. So we need to, as we go to the strategy, do that. And then we talk about some of the other things. One thing I want to spend some time in is prototyping. What's true about most of the applications we're talking about in a department of this size is their operational support systems or the decision support systems. We don't have to implement them statewide. We don't have at this point say I want, $30, $40, $50 million to implement a system statewide. We can prototype them. We can demonstrate them. We can buy a system off the market, in the marketplace. We can implement it in a very pilot small way, maybe one branch office in the state, some people in the central office. We can exercise all aspects of that system before we decide what, if any, modifications need to be made. And we can be assured that those modifications are essential and add value, as I talk about here, that there's a solid business case that's developed by the business and IT for any modifications to these applications. Okay? And then on this portfolio strategy on 22, you'll see essentially, now we may find more, but right now we feel pretty comfortable there are about 8 major portfolios of applications in the department. We have an insurance and claim processing area, that's MMIS and Express, and the major applications. We have these self-sufficiency programs, which I've talked about. We have protective services. And interestingly enough, as we've talked to the business about this and we work on SACWIS, we've gotten the seniors and people with disabilities unit to say, we want to join your project and monitor it because it's likely that that same technology that protects children could be used to protect seniors substantially better than we do today. Licensing, I've mentioned a major opportunity there. Public health has a a wide variety of systems and databases. To some extent, that is driven by their funding mechanism, which is largely driven by grants, and in many cases, those grants come with implement this system that CDC or some other federal agency has recommended. So, but there are opportunities there, and they've seen them, and I'll talk about that later in the plan. Vocational Rehabilitation Services, that's the group that bought a COTS system 5 years ago, has been through two major technology upgrades of it, is in the process of implementing a third, and is current. And the people there are very happy and satisfied with the services that are being provided, because the system really is modern and meets their needs. We shouldn't forget that we run a hospital, and we need a hospital management system. Our system today is 30-plus years old. It's cobbled together. It's very, very much at risk and provides none of the essential services that the hospital needs. And we're working now with the hospital, with the county mental health organization, and we're working on a plan that we can hopefully get integrated with the plan that they're developing for the overall hospital. So when we present that overall hospital plan and what we should do, we'll have in there what we need to do in terms of systems for that hospital. And then, yes.
Excuse me, Bill.
Yeah.
So on page 22, as I'm looking at it, what you basically identified here are, eight different portfolio packages that may have within them different packages of stuff that is specific for their needs, but all of which will be able to integrate together with certain common architecture that would pass back and forth.
Right.
Okay.
Chairman Dallin and Representative Roden. Exactly. We believe in these contexts of these businesses and their related portfolios that in almost every case we believe we can go out and acquire something in the marketplace that meets the needs of those programmatic areas. And that also, as we do that, we can look at where there is a need for integration to do that. I'm not sure that, for example, between vocational rehab and a hospital management system, there's much need for integration. But clearly within self-sufficiency, protective services, areas of public health such as the WIC program, human influences on children, and with our Oregon health plan systems, NMIS, those are areas where there'll need to be integration.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Representative Wilson.
Including things like client, which may be across the board in
yes,
those things.
So exactly.
The information about that client could be shared between the organizations.
Exactly, where we need to do that.
And if a person comes forward to and realizes, I've been working in this area, but I could get services over here, wouldn't have to do another application, possibly?
If we do this right, yes. We'll put the client at the center, and we'll figure out how to integrate these systems in such a way that, you know, that we have the single holistic view of the customer, and I'll talk about that. That's another major goal that we have.
Okay.
All right. So then we say to ourselves, and I'm going to go faster through the rest of this, I think, but this is so critical that you understand. It's where the big bucks are spent.
Can I ask a real quick question before you move on, Bill?
Okay.
And that is, thank you, Mr. Chair, with regards to the ERP,
yes,
Enterprise Resource Planning, are you going to piggyback that onto the enterprise system, the state system, as far as how that operates and everything, so you're not actually developing a new system for DHS? You're going to piggyback that onto the state system.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cromwell, yes, exactly. In fact, I've been in discussions with Don Fleming since almost the day I got here about how that will fit in, and I agree with him that this is a very hard thing to justify an ERP system for the state, you know, unless we make some fundamental changes in how we operate. Now, DHS may have an advantage, and you know, depending on which MMIS system we select, one of the vendors has an integrated, you know, financial management system that's state-of-the-art, you know, part of an ERP application. And so we may be able to help accelerate the state's initiative by having some of the technology in place earlier and being able to piggyback on that. And that's our hope.
Can I ask one more quick?
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that most likely going to be a mandatory application or program that all agencies, as the data center consolidation occurs, that all agencies are going to have to adhere to is the ERP, the enterprise ERP for the entire state? Are you aware of that, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, we are in discussions with the CIO Council, which I'm a very active participant in, about this whole topic. I don't think we've developed a statewide strategy yet, but I can assure you that as we continue discussions where there is an opportunity to leverage this, we will be doing it. The licensing is a current day example of something that actually has, you know, been purchased by the state, and we're leveraging that statewide initiative. That's one of our major goals.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, as we complete this application areas, what would you be able to look at? What would I come in and talk to you about that would be different? What's this point of arrival? And for one, we'd have a portfolio of these integrated COTS applications. They would implement best practice. They would meet federal requirements, which many of our systems don't do today. And they would be configured, installed, and not heavily modified. You'd say, you know, we've been able to implement pretty much standards. We'd have this holistic view of the client that we can clearly demonstrate how we've achieved that and how that impacts the organization. Our staff skills would be there to support business integration requirements. We would have leveraged these statewide opportunities that we definitely want to take advantage of and have been really proactive in that within DHS. It would be what we call service-oriented architecture, which means open and integrated and rules-based and use the current technologies. And finally, IT would be responsive to business process improvement and really be seen as a facilitator and enabler, someone that is very proactive in that arena rather than, you know, an inhibitor to allow that change. Okay?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Crummell.
Thank you. Bill, with regards to the service-oriented architecture, mm-hmm. The one thing that kind of caught my eye there, well, two things, open access and rules-based. My question is this. Since DHS does have a lot of information on folks that is actually HIPAA-constrained and required to be HIPAA-compliant, will some of those rules then define roles as well? Because I know one of the big things about HIPAA compliance is that it has to be role-based access is what's allowed into a client's record, mm-hmm. from a standpoint of what so who's trying to gain that access. So is that part of the rules then that would be going into this to this architecture?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, absolutely it is. Recently, I think the Emergency Board approved a DAS initiative of approximately $8.6 million for security. A significant portion of that is going into a DHS initiative to implement a rules-based security method for applications access. It's an IBM product called Tivoli, and it uses TimTam technologies, which don't ask me what that is because I'm not sure I can give you the answer right off the top. But yes, security is an integral part of this. And while it's open, it really talks about openness is really in the sense of how it is easy to coordinate and integrate these applications. And rules-based is a technology that says I can have 30 different self-sufficiency programs, but I can have different rule bases for each of those. The data may be common, quite frankly, and I don't have to have 30 different systems to achieve that objective. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
I'll talk about, I'm gonna skip through the data architecture because we've kind of alluded to it in the process of applications, but as I said, there's 9 different types of databases or data structures that we're supporting, of which one is other, so there's probably a few more there. I know RDB is one of them, and that is clearly a definition of complexity within the database arena. And then we have, you know, a number of different databases. We try to look at it by business area, by cluster, and take a look at it. And what's interesting about this, kind of humorous, is the head of the health services group said, well, I guess I'm the winner. And I said, no, it's more like golf. You're the D player at 121. The SPD at 4 is the best handicap in this foursome. So, but it's an interesting set of data to look at. We have 26% of our databases are desktop based. That creates problems. That's a potentially good thing in terms of end user computing and more quickly meeting the needs of the business unit. But many of the things that we've done in this area of desktop databases have grown into enterprise or cluster applications, which they really weren't designed to be. So that's one of our issues. And then, of course, IT did set some standards several years back. DB2 and Access are the two major DHS standards, but it's very clear from what we've done that we haven't implemented those standards. We have over 86% of our databases are non-standard. We have three terabytes of data, which sounds like a lot, maybe. It's 2.2 million diskettes to give you some kind of sense of how much data that is. That's not gigantic for an organization of our size and complexity and types of applications we run. This is a modest amount of information that we're managing at our applications layer. But again, we have 59 different client databases that we found, and some of these additional ones are, you know, in these desktop areas. And there, you know, it's hard to get a single view of the client when you've got 59 different systems that you have to maintain for those clients. So the issues here are complexity, double entry and cost, skill sets, again, are spread very thin, and inconsistent data quality, which is, you know, not consistent with one of our business goals. So what we want to do here is reduce the complexity again. We need to start with the business, though, in this, and understand business processes and business simplification. The business really needs to drive a lot of the work in this area. We need data quality and management and interoperability processes implemented. We need enterprise tools and methods, integrated data architectures, DBA skills that anticipate future needs. These are some of the strategies that we think will make a difference in this area. And the point of arrival for us in here, in this area, is that we'll see standardized data management infrastructure that we can talk about, the single view of the client. We'll have good metadata, data about the data, so we'll be able to know what the definitions are and properly extract information based on the questions that we're asking, what data is relevant. And we'll probably use more data warehouses we talk about in here. We have the client index, which is growing in importance and use within the department, especially as part of our forecasting app operations, and we're spending more time looking at that application. We have DSERS in the MMIS arena, which allows us to analyze the medical payments and a lot of different information there. Our concern is that we haven't really use those to the extent that they're possible, and we need to do a better job of getting the business involved with these and actually using these technologies in their day-to-day work. Okay? Networking computing is all about scenic, basically, and this gives you some idea of our participation in this. I think ourselves, DAS, and ODOT represent some 90% of the benefits and impact associated with the consolidation of our data centers. We ourselves have 338 servers within our environment, 9 operating systems, again, massive complexity that we have to manage. I think this little footnote of 140 distinct skills required in this area of our business to maintain the current environment is just demonstrable of that complexity. Our transaction volumes, interestingly enough, are not that large. We have 2.7 billion CICS online transactions, basically. That's not gigantic, especially when you look at it over a biennium of 2 years. 214,000 batch jobs we run, again. 10,900 miles of paper printed. As I say internally, that just demonstrates that Department of Human Services is helping the economy of Oregon grow by using too much paper, maybe. What's interesting here also to note is 10...
Excuse me, yes.
What does CICS stand for again?
Customer information control system.
Control system. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's the mainframe transactional processing system.
Thank you.
Okay. We have 10 terabytes of storage overall. You recall 3 terabytes for the applications. So what that says to you is that almost 2 times that amount is used storing documents and presentations and emails and other kinds of documentation, EDMS documentation, others within the department. So that's where the growth is. I mean, when you look at what's going to happen in the state, that's where the issues associated with the growth of storage requirements are going to be. Not necessarily in applications. That's pretty well, you know, current and backed up and archived, but this is a big area of concern.
Question.
Yes.
Yes, Representative Reverend.
But also part of the reason for doing this is you won't have as many duplicated pieces, some of which is different from the other one, even though it may be the same client in 3 different places. They could have different information on each of them in 3 different places.
Right.
So we will. This should be cleaned up a bit by the time this is all done to allow for more room to store more, but I mean, it never ends. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Reverend, I think that's true, that there are efficiencies and we'll get efficiencies as we consolidate to common applications like email and some of these other things that are part of the scenic initiative, that'll be beneficial. On 33, we just give you an idea of the different applications that or different systems and where these servers are. I think it's interesting to note that most of these servers are not in our data center, and it's one of the prime reasons that I argued very strongly with the CIO Council that we needed to establish the new state data center's point of demarcation to the agencies at the wall plate, we call it, so that they have responsibility not for all of these servers, regardless of where they're located. Whether they're located in the data center or not. That's the appropriate and proper way, I think, to manage this, and that's the way that Scenic is now headed. The next slide just basically is designed to show you that while many of our non-DHS and DHS clients came through us, through the Internet, through DAS, through a firewall, in the current architecture that DHS had implemented years back, there were a large number, I think almost 80 in this case, organizations that would come to us and come directly into our systems, not go through any kind of security perimeter. And this is one of the issues I know that Mike Fries talked to you about and that you're all aware of from the security initiatives that we're working on, and DHS is making major progress in resolving this problem and making sure that there is a strong perimeter. And I'll talk about that again in security. Issues in this arena, first one that popped up, which surprised me, is we really don't have any specific plan for disaster recovery or back business continuity, critical infrastructure protection, those kinds of things. That's something that comes, we hope, with Scenic, and we'll be working hard. Very limited operations. Again, this splintered staff skill that's across too many applications. We have facilities issues I listed here, security vulnerabilities that we're addressing, and lack some significant tools that we need. So the strategy is essentially on page 36 is Scenic, the centerpiece of that. We're participants. We're fully integrated into that. We're very strong supporters on that at all levels. But I'd like to point out to people that in the short term, we have things to do to continue to work on, to be prepared for Scenic, to get better prepared for Scenic, to solve some of the security issues, and we've got a lot of these things underway. And post Scenic, you know, the department still will be relying on the state to provide services, and we need to communicate. We need to have, real strong communications about what they're doing, service levels being provided, what we need that's new and different in the organization, how they're changing things and how it affects us. We have implemented a very strong change advisory board in the department. You can't change anything in our systems without going before your peers and explaining what you're going to do and why and how. And we want to make sure that when the state data center goes into effect, they have to come before us before they make changes also that could impact our operations. So a point of arrival is you know, this nirvana of the new data center. Fully consolidated network and computing environment, much better performance and reliability, especially in the network, state-of-the-art facility, this defense in-depth security posture, et cetera. I think you can read the rest of those. And then we have just a picture of the new data center. All right. Customer service and support is as I said, a paradigm shift for the department. This has been one of our great successes in only 9 months. I mean, we really have a most extensive customer service focus. The management team has initiated a program to train all aspects of IT in customer service, a special program actually that the Department of Forestry discovered and that we're going to be taking our people through. But in this area, we support 150 locations throughout the state. We have pretty good ratios of support of people supported to technicians. 101 to 150 technicians in the field and 1 to 400 approximately in terms of the help desk are pretty good numbers. I mean, those would benchmark well against Gartner or any of the other benchmarks that are out there. Our help desk is becoming better, and this is actually seen in the increased number of calls that we're getting. You know, in before we started this initiative, a couple years ago actually, you know, we didn't get very many calls because we didn't provide very much help. You know, and so, yeah, so you look at this and say, well, gee, your help calls are going up. Now, obviously, you're not providing as good a service. Actually, not. It's a function of providing better services that people are calling now, and we're able to reach very high levels of satisfaction. And look at these numbers. The help desk is now solving 72% of the calls they get. That's really terrific. We'd like to do better, maybe up to 80%. But that means if you call us, we're giving you an answer while you're on the phone and solving your problem. That's what makes a difference. And then on the first call, we're solving almost half of those calls that we get, and that's good, and we, again, want to make it better, but those are pretty good stats. So while we're making good progress in this area, we got the same kind of complexity to deal with. We have 69 different desktop images. Now, why does that happen? If you look to the right, it's because we have such old technologies. We have technology on the desktop that goes back almost 10 years. You know yourself that over 10 years there have been massive changes in the technology occurring on a very rapid basis, you know, almost every 6 months. And so we have this technology that's been brought over all these years, and we have to support it all. You know, and it has to run against all of our applications in the department. We're addressing this problem. This year we started at the state's initiative in IT asset management, which I'm sure you'll hear about from Daz, to have a plan in place to replace and modernize our desktops, to do that on a cycle basis. We're looking at about every 4 years cycling through the technology. That will dramatically reduce the complexity of the technology that we have to support on the desktop. And this year alone, you know, we've bought a large number of PCs. We've basically replaced all of the 450 megahertz and below equipment. So we've gotten pretty far down the road. We need to continue that process, and that's important to us. On 42, I'll just briefly cover this. You see, we haven't locked down our desktops. Indicative of this is the amount of 18,000 instances of non-standard software on the desktop. This is a problem across many, many businesses, not just the state. And the technology is starting to evolve to the point where we can lock this down and really only have, you know, applications on the desktops that should be there and that are authorized to be there. And a part of this is changing the mindset of our employees to realize this is not your personal computer, this is a state workstation and needs to be, you know, managed accordingly. So we're getting that message out.
Bill, I'm going to ask you to save a trip back for you. Can you get us into the abbreviated synopsis for him? I have several of the representatives that are champing at the bit here.
Okay.
But I know I have some questions that are going to take at least 20 minutes of our time, so I'm going to defer to Representative Roblin for right now, and
I'll
take your question.
Quick question. You know, I'm looking at the processor speeds.
Yes.
A number of these would not handle new applications.
Right.
I mean, so they just have to be gone.
Absolutely.
So, by 2007, if we're going to be looking at a new application set, there's a big investment in new computers, just to make them so that they could actually run the applications we want.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Roman, that is absolutely correct. But when we get there, we will have been through this program for about 4 years, and we'll be in the last year of replacement. So we shouldn't have anything older than 4 years hopefully by that time if we can sustain that investment. Okay? So to pick up the pace a little bit, let's go to the strategies, and basically it's to provide good, you know, really good customer service. These are some of the things that we can do to make a difference. A big part of this is to be very proactive in getting processes in place that are common, understandable, and that are repeatable over and over time. Quality comes through the ability to repeat the process over and over again and get the same result. So a lot of these things on page 46 that we talk about, you know, are being implemented to have very common methodologies. Staff is a critical aspect of this plan, starting on page 48. And you can see the as we go through this, the issues that we face. Most of our staff, and we're really focused here on the applications staff, not on the other aspects of IT, we are very heavily loaded up with developers, mostly COBOL, some client server, some web. We have a good mix of DBAs and systems architects and not a whole lot of business process engineering expertise, and that's really critical. Secondly, as you go to 49, this is a pretty critical piece of data too, because traditionally the department has said, well, we'll wait till people get to the higher levels of the IS classification, and then we'll encourage them to go into management. And as you can see here, with the overlap of our management positions, that's not a very viable strategy. There's no incentive to go into management if you've gotten to that level. So what this tells me is we need to start career planning a lot earlier when people are 3, 4, and 5 levels in the technical areas to say, do you want to go into management? How do we steer your career in that direction? And then start them off, you know, at a lower level. E is the people that report to me, and I think that's a pretty big starting point. Next slide basically talks about in-house skills and how those are changing to be more business and less technical. It's just market data out there. The issues here are critical, that the current skill set does not match our anticipated future needs. We need to change the staff mix from developers to implementers, integrators, and process experts. This is difficult to do in an environment that is, you know, that has a strong labor management piece to it. So it's something we need to really work on, and then we need to work on these, you know, on the management development side of it. If I go to 53, it really shows you the challenge in terms of point of arrival that we have to get to. And it's a real transformation of our skill set. What we anticipate 6 years out, and this is about a 6-year strategy, so to speak, is that we'll need a lot of people in applications and packages, a lot more people in business processes, pretty much the same DBA, SA, and project managers. We'll always need some developers, because we'll be integrating applications, and like we'll always have some legacy applications. We already know applications like Oregon Access are not going to go away right away. There's some newer systems that will stay with us. And then we're doing more of this contracting and buying, so we need to be better at managing these vendor relationships that we have. Okay? So staff is a really critical aspect of our plan. Security, we mentioned, we were a part of the critical vulnerability assessment that the state did. We found issues with confidentiality, integrity, and accessibility, and these were the issues that we found in that regard. As we show in 57, the reason for our exposure, our significant exposure, is that we had so many partners who could come directly into our environment versus what we wanted. So we have obviously a number of security issues that we're addressing at the present. Our current plan in this area is we have initiatives that will address about 70% of the total critical issues and moderately critical issues that were identified in that assessment, and the rest we're working closely with DAS and the Scenic Initiative to address.
Bill, if I may interrupt.
Yeah.
The $8.6 million that the Joint Committee approved and that went through the E-Board, that money is into play immediately, and security is an issue you're addressing just as rapidly as you can.
Mr. Chairman, yes, and members of the committee, yes, that we represent a very large amount of that in DHS. I don't know the exact numbers yet. I think Daz is working with our security office on all the detailed planning, but I know in the area of securing our perimeter and upgrading many of our servers, which is a critical aspect of our plan, giving us resources to do that, and then this role-based access technology being the first to demonstrate and roll that out, those are all areas that we're integrally involved with Daz and the security people.
Do you have a time frame for when we could say we have a reasonably secure system at the Department of Human Services, or when we've met industrial standards or state standards? A timeline, a finish point, an end point.
Representative Down, I don't know that I can give that out. I think Daz is really leading this initiative. It'd be better maybe that for them to say than me. We certainly are working as fast as we can to close the most egregious areas. So we're working to get these 80 partners to go through our firewall and have the security area we need. I would imagine as we implement Scenic, we will be much closer because we will be building in security at the beginning and not trying to retrofit our systems to a secure environment.
Thank you, Bill. Okay.
If I go to 60, you'll see the point of arrival here that we're working on with Daz, where all partners will come through a firewall. We'll have this DMZ that is really just another firewall that segregates and creates another layer of security you need to get deeper into our applications, and that's more tightly controlled. And I think as you see all of us together, you'll see a lot of these DMZs because we can do those at an application level if we need to. So if public health is really concerned about the HIV medical marijuana files, that we can add, you know, even more security there to make it very, very difficult, you know, for anyone to get to that information. Okay? So when we arrive, and this is important to think about, I think, as you think about security, we'll have this defense in depth security posture. And what that means is that we have a level of security awareness and training going on, not only within IT, but within the organization. Our workforce and partners understand and practice these security measures that we'll be implementing. We've secured all the elements of the technology as described here. If there is a threat, we know about it. That's not true today. There have been threats, and we haven't known. So we'll have the technology to know when a threat exists and to mitigate it. And finally, we'll be able to mitigate our general risk structure. Obviously, by the way, the business plays a critical role in this because they will define for us who needs access and when and how and those kinds of things. That they still own the information that's there, not IT, and I think we need not forget that. I'm going to skip real quickly now. Customer relations really is an internal issue within the department of where are we positioned? How do people view us? This is changing at a rapid pace. We have many of the things that we talk about here actually already implemented, like our governance council and our ISM roles and responsibilities and things. We've attacked who does, you know, the what and who question or what and how questions that are in this plan. That's really important. We know the business needs to lead us on the what's. We need to define the how's. That's our professional responsibility. So that's what that's all about. And then in a culture as old as we have, and it tends to be pretty rock solid, we need to make some changes. We need to get off the scarcity routine. And believe me, I don't think I've heard since we came out with this plan another person tell me that we have a scarcity of resources. That's good news. That's happening in terms of our culture. And we need to build on the strength. And the strength of our culture is that we really, as an IT organization, understand the mission of this department and how it serves citizens, and we are totally committed to support that mission and capability, and we've demonstrated that. Most recently, when a group of people got together on their own, somewhat on their own initiative, and fixed issues with our child welfare system to make it available for extended hours. And they did that. They did it across multiple agencies, actually, and did it on time and didn't ask for extra money, and they just got it done. So they knew that children are at risk because of the issues that were in that area. The balance of the plan, there's one slide I want to take you to, and it's about customer business functions, something we're causing the business to. It's on page 77 of the plan. And what we did is we went to all of our businesses. Public health was our poster child for this. And we said, identify your programs and identify the business functions within those programs. And they went through this process and developed this matrix. And what they discovered surprised them as well as it surprised us. For example, in over 50% of the programs, there's a screening application. There's a GIS application. There's an activity tracking function going on. There's partner and provider directories, client demographics. And down to 20%, you see licensing. So they start to realize that there's opportunity here to attack applications and systems from a totally different perspective, from a functional perspective that's shared across not only, in the case, public health, but across the whole department. Their licensing initiative that they've started is now going to be shared by SPD and by CAF, the other two major clusters of that make up DHS. So very, very important information that's coming out of that, and something that our business process improvement group grabbed onto immediately and said, we want this that can help us, you know, plan our initiatives. The balance of the plan, and we cover our products and services. It's important for people to know what it is we're talking about if they want to know what project services. Advances in technology are critical. We need to think about these and not design solutions just for today, but thinking in the future. Wireless self-service is a critical opportunity with these web-enabled applications. Open source is something I'm very interested in exploring with the open source community, what role they can play in our strategies, mobile computing, et cetera, and we want to establish those. And then finally, it's important that we maximize our strengths and opportunities, minimize our weaknesses and threats, so we help to define these. So, in fact, as we develop our detailed plans, our tactical planning, that we're making sure we're doing exactly that. And so with that, I'll finish. I will tell you that I've probably presented this plan now 15 or 20 times. I am doing it tomorrow for the county IT executives that I'm meeting with. I think it's being very well received. We're in the process now within IT of developing our tactical plans. And what that involves is taking here the strategic business plan, pulling out what we can achieve in the next year in the plan, what we think is doable, and then relating that to quarter-by-quarter expectations of what we'll get done. And as part of my role as the CIO, I issue a report to Gary and the Cabinet every quarter that says, here's what we said we'd do, here's what we did, here's what we'll do the next quarter. And that will keep this a living document. This is being integrated into how we're managing IT within the department. This is not a plan that was developed to be put on the shelf. So thank you very much.
Yes, we have a question, Representative Bernie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Three questions. On page 7 of the presentation, and first of all, Bill, I want to point out that this is a hugely monumental task you're undertaking here.
Yes.
I'm incredulous at the extent of this thing. On page 7, you said that the networking and computing services section will be going to CNIC. But I guess I'm trying to make it, I want to make sure I understand, once this CNIC is built, mm-hmm. and this computer equipment's installed and we've got all the software there and everything, are all of these major projects, for example, MMIS and SACWIS and all the, are these all going to be residing on that computer equipment in that facility?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Burley, exactly. When we consolidate, what CNIC is about is taking all of the servers or technology that, you know, is back in the closet, the wide area network, the local area networks, and moving accountability and responsibility of that to the state data center and that organization. And then when we develop new applications like MMIS, we will be putting our technology into that data center.
Okay.
And they will be using that network.
Okay. And on page 16,
mm-hmm.
Actually, a couple. If I understood correctly, you said, actually on page 9 to start with, you said that the governor and his recommended budget did include SACWIS to be funded, but I was just curious, on page 16, SACWIS is not one of your 10 largest, most complex applications. Is that any reflection or
Mr. Chairman,
more important?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, the actually, if you look at the Family and Child Information System FACES, that is our current, quote, SACWIS system. SACWIS stands for Statewide Automated Child Welfare Information System. It's the generic term for those applications. Now, just some additional background. FACES was started over 9 years ago. It was a custom-developed in-house initiative that the department undertook. After 9 years, we went through an audit, and we met 22% of the federal requirements in that application. And the recommendation came to me literally within weeks of arriving in the department that we should continue our work, and it would probably take another 5 to 7 years to become fully compliant. That was the first piece of data I got. The second piece was that this application was written in Smalltalk and used Sybase as the technology, underlying technologies. Those technologies are basically dead. It's very hard to even find people that know anything about Smalltalk, and I think we have maybe the 4 or 5 people in the state that know anything about that language. And Sybase is not our standard, and it has deteriorated in the marketplace. And so given those two pieces of information, I went to the Assistant Director for Child, Adults, and Families, Ramona Foley, and I said, Ramona, this is not a good business strategy. This is not a good technology strategy. She immediately, you know, said, you're right, and we notified the feds that we were going to stop that initiative. Administration for Children and Families, we've actually already gotten approval for stopping, and we're going to start a new initiative to bring in an application from another state that meets 100% of the federal requirements right off the bat. And that's been and she's been a very strong supporter of this initiative as we've gone through the budgeting process. I might add that if we don't, as a state, fix this, we are liable for the payments that were made by the federal government to support FACES, which is, I think, approximately $12 million that we might have to pay back. So that's an important business criteria for this initiative.
Last question, Mr. Chairman. Earlier you had discussed agency culture and employee morale, which is a big issue. But I'm curious how, in general, are they embracing this notion really of centralizing? Again, history's kind of repeating itself in this scenario because, you know, as evidenced by the proliferation of all your non-standard databases and desktop applications and stuff, and now what you want to do is impose these standards and say that we will have certain either programming languages or applications or operating systems on our platforms. You know, you're taking a lot of that control back, and I'm just curious, how are people reacting to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, actually that has not been an issue. You know, OIS has been centralized for 3 or 4, several years now, and that has become accepted. The real challenge, quite frankly, for us was to create a sense of understanding of what the business needs were and how we could go about addressing them and building that relationship with my peers who are assistant directors running these programs. And we're making good progress in gaining their support for doing this. We've extended that down to our governance council, which is all the deputy assistant directors are part of to make up that unit. We're extending it down through the ISMs, the Information System Management Committees that are in the clusters themselves. And I think they're, quite frankly, excited about the energy and the focus that we're bringing on their problems and to acknowledge that there are issues that we need to address. And a lot of this is historical.
Let me take a crack at that, Mr. Chairman and Representative Burley, if I can. I think that everything that Bill has told you is, of course, right on the mark. But there are some employees who chafe a little bit about losing all the software that they've brought from home and from other places and put on the desktop. And we've frankly said, you can't do that. We can't support it. It's not an appropriate use of, in some cases, of state-owned property. And now that we're really buying up-to-date, good hardware for them, we're going to secure that hardware in a way that makes it difficult, if not impossible, for them to bring off-the-shelf, or not off-the-shelf, but from-home software. Now, in fairness to our employees, I think some of them have done that as a way to get their job done better. They've done their own workarounds, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, they've set up their own little databases on their computer and so on, and did it in good faith to try to be more productive. But the end result is we have this proliferation of stuff on our on computers that we can't manage, and we're not going to permit it anymore. And so there will be some, I think, anxiety about the fact they're going to lose some of that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I had Representative Worth, you had a question?
I have several questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'm trying to figure out, just in the 10 largest and most complex systems, where does something like the employment-related daycare fall?
I don't think it's there.
Well, it's not one of the largest systems. The RDC is not anywhere near as large as these are.
Okay.
It falls in. I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't answer that very well, Representative Worth. It falls as part of the self-sufficiency program under the children and families, but it's such a small system that it wouldn't show up here on this list.
I guess what I'm wondering is, how does the current system, or the current complex of systems, how do they contribute to tracking down welfare fraud? I mean, how do we use the current IT resources that we have, say, to check to make sure that employment-related daycare is really being contracted with the actual daycare provider, or the person is a family of four but says she's renting a room. Mm-hmm. How do we track that with the current IT?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and Representative Worth, that is done right now within these silos. So if you look at MMIS and the health plan, they have the DSERS program, which is doing analysis to try to catch situations where, you know, there may be fraud or abuse of the system. That's true in I know food stamps and some of the other programs. They've done some form probably of extraction of information into a little database and are doing their own analysis. But there has been no overreaching way to do that, especially across these programs. So as we look at self-sufficiency and as we develop a strategy to implement a system that will integrate 30-some self-sufficiency programs, including the one you mentioned, into a common system, I think we'll be much more capable and able to implement those kinds of capabilities.
So follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Worth.
So what's your ballpark figure on the percentage of welfare fraud cases that we are able to detect now with our current resources?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, I'm not sure I can give you a good answer to that today. I mean, I'm happy to have us do that. But welfare isn't, I think, as you know, what we used to have. We don't make welfare payments. You have to be in employment, you have to be in education programs, you have to be in training programs. It's not simply just a check. We've also, on the food stamps side, really redoubled our efforts on the error rate on the food stamps, because we had one of the highest error rates in the country. That error rate today is almost at the national average in 9 months. So it just proves to me that if we really focus on this, we can do that job. In terms of the Medicaid fraud, Bill mentioned DSERS, which is a system that checks for fraud on billed hours and billed services from hospitals and physicians and so on. We can also check for services that have been provided for the same client in more than one way, and all that's going on right now. One of the things on ERDC, employment-related daycare particularly, and I haven't I haven't laid this on Bill, but I'd like to see us move to a system like Oklahoma has, which is they load the eligibility for employment-related daycare on a card like the food stamp card, and when you show up at the daycare operator's house, they have a little machine that reads it. And I've seen the system in Oklahoma, and in any given day, at any part of the day, they know exactly which children are in daycare and where they are and what the costs are. And it's cut their fraud dramatically, they think, in Oklahoma. Now, that's not a difficult system. I mean, it's a fairly routine, fairly easy system, but it has to be added to his workload. So,
if I might change the focus just a bit from inside the agency to the overall program. Another follow-up?
Can I just have one final question? Thank you, Mr. Chair. The consolidation of personnel that comes along with CNIC, will this be done through elimination of positions? Elimination.
Let me take a crack at that. CNIC started when I was running DAS and when the governors first came in. And there are several positions that are going to be eliminated, because when you take 32 data centers, you eventually collapse them into one, and 14 networks, which you bring down to maybe one or two, there are going to be jobs that we aren't going to use. To the extent that we can, we are going to try to work with employees to see if there are other positions, vacant positions in government, that they qualify for as a result of attrition and retirements and so on like that. I mean, that's good business for us. We're not intending to create new positions for people, but we are going to work with people to try to find places for them, just as we have done when we closed Fairview and other efforts that we have.
Just one final, clarification.
Go ahead, Representative Worth.
Do we know, is there going to be any prioritization that the eliminating the positions that we eliminate vacant positions first?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, correct. I mean, we have a number of people, and what is it, 200 and
something, 10 or something like that.
There's a fixed number. We know exactly who these people are and what their job classifications are and which agencies they're at. And so, you know, we know which jobs are going to go away. We also, though, will begin to work with those individuals to say, you know, here's an agency because of retirement, vacancies, or other reasons, has a position open. You know, we're going to try to facilitate the movement of people into those positions.
Yeah.
Because, again, we think that's good business, not to lose people that we've invested in.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Worth, let me just add to that. We're managing this issue today. We've had, I think, three or four positions within DHS, within our network and computing services group, which have become vacant. People have gone to other assignments, and we're keeping those positions vacant. I think in some cases we're backfilling with some limited duration staff until the move is made. So we're going to try to manage down. We don't know until we go through the process how many of our staff will be successful in getting placements at the new data center and in the network computing group that will be there. We hope it's a bunch, but whoever doesn't, we're going to be working with to, you know, do what we're doing on MIS, which is to plan their career transitions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill. Representative Wilburn, you had a question?
Yeah, hopefully a quick one. With all these different languages and all these different centers, to capture that data and get it into the new center, we're going to have people developing protocols that take this data and translate it to the new one, or is that part of the contract that we're looking at? How are we capturing this old data, I guess?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Robin, actually the data center consolidation is pretty much the physical movement of the technology into the data center, so the data goes with it. So there's nothing we specifically have to do from a applications area to be ready to serve the customers just as they were when they were, you know, right across the street versus over on Airport Road. So there's no, what we do need to do is have very well thought out plans to test in the new environment to make sure everything is working properly after we make the change.
I've saved the final word for our most senior member, Representative Crumble. But before we go to him with any questions, we have a timeline from DAS or CNIC, and I look at your timeline and an overlap. And so the question is, and I've asked it before, your timeline working with Mr. Fleming is compatible and the transition can be complete. And what's really going to happen in about 2007, when everything is ready to go, we will take the box from the Department of Human Services over to the data center, set it up on a raised floor, and away we go. And there has been coordination with your department and their department, and that timeline is livable by you that we received last week. And so that covers my questions. Now, Representative Crummell, I'll give you the floor.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. With regards to the applications and desktop and all of that kind of stuff, have you thought about moving away from the desktop technology and moving into a thin client type of technology? Potentially, and I believe that Sun maybe has come out with a product, and it's actually a smart card type of technology, so you have a workstation and a person can basically wherever they're at, and potentially you could put a workstation in their home, mm-hmm. and they could, so wherever they're at, they're on a secure connection. The data all stays on one in one place, and then they can do their work. They could leave a document up and walk away from it and go sign in somewhere else, you know, sign out and then sign in somewhere else, and that same document would be there for them to continue working on it. Have you thought about going to that type of a system and as opposed to staying with the desktop technology where that allows the opportunity for our employees to use non-standard or unapproved type of software and install it into their systems, which then brings it into the state system as a whole?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Crummell, yes, we are looking at those technologies. If you think about most of what we'll be implementing will be web-enabled applications on a go-forward basis. That seems to be, you know, a technology that's going to have some staying power overall. And in that environment, you don't need necessarily what's on the desktop today in terms of processing capability. I believe in the next number of years we'll see open source technologies that so we buy office systems and other technologies on an open source basis proliferate, if I can say that word, proliferate. So that would be another technology in addition to some of the thin clients that Sun has been pushing that for quite a few years, the idea of knocking kind of Microsoft out of the market by going to these thin clients. But so that's a factor, I think, in the process. Cost is also a factor, obviously, that we need to consider. I think you're aware that the most recent Smart Buy program really drove down the cost of desktop technologies for us. I think for DHS it was somewhat under $1,000, including monitors and, you know, all the peripheral equipment that goes with the computer itself. So all of those variables are in the mix. I would say if we were to move significantly in one direction or the other, it would probably come as a result of work by the CIO Council to lead the state in that direction, not just DHS. But it's you're very correct. That's one of the technologies we need to be conscious of.
I would just point out, making a call on a school system, actually Riverdale High School, mm-hmm. Where they were using a thin client type of technology with a Linux operating system, mm-hmm. found that to be very intriguing, and wonder, I mean, I recognize that that's kind of a small operation, one small high school that has, you know, 250 or 300 students, but they were running all of their administrative applications. Everything that they needed to do was being done on that, and that way too, when a student was using the system, it was operating at whatever speed they had their primary server at, which was a real advantage.
Do we have any more questions for the Department of Human Services? With that, I would like to thank you very much. I asked some specific questions, and through our administrator, Dallas, we got very specific answers. Thank you for your time. I'd like to thank the members of the committee. I think we had a very fruitful meeting today. And with that, I will adjourn the meeting.